The subject of this morning's shiur is the Gemara's accounts of a very, very important, famous episode told in Sefer Yecheskel, which is the Haftorah for Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. So it's well known not only because the story it tells is well known, but also because anybody who goes to shul on Pesach is bound to hear it. It's not the case like every other parak in Nach. Not everybody knows about them, but this one, people know about it because of our Torah. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we have the practice of hearing our Torah, so we learn a little about Nach, right? The story is, as you know, the resurrection of the Atzmos Yuveshos that Yecheskel encountered. The parak, it's Parak Lamed Zayin and Sefer Yecheskel. Hashem, the Navi had described how Hashem came upon him and he placed him inside a great valley, Bika, which was full of bones, and Hashem showed him all the many bones, and they were very, very dry, and then Hashem tells him, can such bones be resurrected? Can they live? And then Hashem says, yes, they can be. Prophesies upon them that they will be resurrected, that they will come to life, and then that happens, and then the bones start to take flesh and sinews and skin. Then Hashem says, can they have spirit? And yes, they can have spirit, and they become living creatures. And then, finally, the Navi concludes by saying that... Where's the pasuk? That although avda sikva senu, people say our hope is lost, that is not true. You can see how hope becomes revived. That's what's told in the Navi in short. And Chazal were trying to figure out what this means. And I'm interested in this not only because of the fact that this is a very interesting episode. Just imagine it, visualize it. It's like really striking. And can't forget it. It's one of the kind of classic episodes of Nevuah. But I'm interested in it from the perspective of our own Seder HaLimud. Because what we have been doing over these years is looking at agadahs that seem very fantastical and strange to us. And we've tried to interpret them. And now what you have here is Parak and Nach, which seems very, very fantastical and strange, and how Chazal interpreted them. So there is a real analogy between how Chazal approached an agada, a story, which was very mysterious and enigmatic, and how we do approach agadotes, which are somewhat mysterious and enigmatic, and perhaps we can learn from how Chazal approached it to how we approach agadotes. In other words, there's a kind of an analogy. Obviously, there's an important disanalogy. This is Nevuah. Chazal not Nevi'im. It's Agadata. But the overall strategy is interesting. And so the first question you might ask is, did this whole episode actually take place in Yecheskel? Does this Sefer describe a lived event? What do you think?
So the question is, could it have just been a vision?
Mm-hmm.
Or was there an actual miracle that occurred?
That's what I'm saying. That's the question I'm asking. Did this actually take place? Did Yecheskel miraculously resurrect dry bones and make them into living beings, living persons? Or is it all a mashal? Was this all a part of the Chalom HaNevuah?
So there are different opinions on how to look at them. I think like on our own, without being told what it is, even though we know that there's some stories in Tanakh are allegorical, I don't think we can just decide it offhand. All right, well, this is one of those stories unless we know. So unless like someone like the Rambam comes and tells us that this all happened in Nevuah, I don't think it's right to assume that this didn't happen.
Right, so that's a fair point. And in general, when we approach agadotes in our Seder HaLimud, we try to do it in a conservative and responsible way, but question is, how did Chazal approach it? So actually, the question I ask you, did this actually take place or not, you can't have a wrong answer to that because it's a machlokas in the Gemara. It's a machlokas in the Gemara. If you look at the Gemara that you have here, we're not going to go into it this too much because I want to look at the actual Gemara's explanations. But right about five lines from the first bracket, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, MS Mashal Haya. In truth, it was a Mashal. Amala Rabbi Nechemya, MS Lama Mashal. A Mashal Lama MS. Is it true or is it a Mashal? Ella be MS Mashal. In truth, it is a Mashal. So Rabbi Yehuda's position is that this never took place. In the real world, it was a Chalom Hanav, it was a vision, it was a Nevuah, and it was a Mashal.
Is it possible that a true event can represent a Mashal for a greater event?
That's not what this means. It means that it never actually took place.
I'm asking on his question, saying...
MS Mashal Haya?
Yeah. Meaning, you can do a minor event which is symbolic of a greater event that happened.
Yeah, but that's not what the Gemara says.
So the thought that came to my mind...
I hear what you're saying, but that's not the Gemara's interpretation of it.
The thought that came to my mind is just from J.K. Rowling. She had a line from Dumbledore that just because it's in your imagination, why does that mean that it didn't actually happen? That something can be a mashal, but the underlying lesson is an emistic lesson.
No, you're absolutely right, and in fact, they say about paranoids, sometimes paranoids have enemies too. It could be both a mashal and a real event, which you were saying, but that's not
clearly not what the Gemara is saying.
No, correct. That's right. So the Gemara says it never, and how can I be so sure of that? Because look at the other mandiyomer. Rabbi Elazar ben Osher Rabbi Yosef Glili Omer, Mesim Shehichya Cheskel Aluli Eretz Yisrael. These Mesim that Yecheskel resurrected made Aliyah. V'nasu Nashim, and they married women. V'holidu Banim Ubanos, and they gave birth to children, sons and daughters. Amar Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira al Raglav. Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira stood on his feet for Amar. Ani mibnei bnehem. I am amongst their descendants. V'halalu tefillin she'niach li avi abba mehem. And here's a tefillin that I have that go back all these generations to the folks who were resurrected at this bikkah in this valley.
I
so
that's why Rehuda's statement that this is a mushal. He says, "Oh yeah, am I a mushal?"
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Am I a mushal? Right. So it's pretty clear that the shaila on the Gemara here is whether it literally happened or whether it did not literally happen. By the way, what does this remind you of, this Rebutim and Besera Ol Al Raglav?
It's Irani Dachas.
Yes, Irani Dachas.
There's another one, I think, Eov, whether or not he existed.
That's a different issue. That's true. We discussed that with Basra. Yes, but Ben Sora, yeah, exactly correct. Ben Sora Ramor, Reb Yonasan says, I was there, I saw destroyed mound of the Irani Dachas, I was there. So you have people attesting to the fact that this can't be a mashal, it has to be real. It's kind of an interesting machlokas. When we approach agadotas, again, obviously there are differences, but you see how the Gemara is struggling with the question of, can this fantastical event actually have taken place, or are we to interpret it in some kind of metaphorical or allegorical or parabolic way? And just as the Gemara struggles with their, quote, agadata, that is what we saw in Sefer Cheskel, so too when we learn agadatas, we struggle with the same question, how literally are we to take it?
So I don't know if the Gemara has any problem saying that something miraculously occurred. The Gemara doesn't shy away from miracles.
Nope.
But I guess they're having a very particular argument. Did this happen or didn't it? If a miracle had happened, undoubtedly, I don't know if there's an afkamina, but my point is that I don't know if it's a question of whether or not this could have happened.
Well, it certainly could have happened.
Did it happen or didn't it?
Right, right. It could have happened. Miracles happen. Right. But the Gemara is, there's a fantastical, odd, unusual story, and the Gemara is, could it happen, did it happen? So just like the Gemara has different approaches to these fantastical events described in Nach, so too interpreters of Agadata likewise have some, there are some literalists who insist, particularly the Ashkenazic school, insist on interpreting Agadata literally. And the more rationalist school says, no, it's not literal, it's a mushal. So there's an analogy. Obviously, there are disanalogies, as I mentioned, but there's an analogy. Okay. So now we're going to look at the... and by the way, this whole sugya appears, it's in Perek HaChelek. It's a part of a long, long sugya which tries to tackle the question of Tchias HaMesim. What are the sources of Tchias HaMesim in the Torah? Wouldn't it surprise one that this Perek in Yecheskel is brought into the discussion of whether there is Tchias HaMesim. Not that whether there is, but how you can prove it. The Gemara, of course, affirms Tchias HaMesim and tries to prove it from many places, and this is part of that that conversation. So, now we're going to see, the Gemara asks, Uman Ninhu Mesim Shehich Yecheskel. Who were these corpses that Yecheskel resurrected? That's the Gemara's question. And the Gemara is going to offer five different interpretations, and we are going to look at and try to interpret those interpretations. So if you stick to the analogy of learning Agadotus, what we're doing, if you think of the, if you don't mind my framing it this way, because it just so, to me, relates to what we've been trying to do over these past couple of years. We're seeing the Gemara doing it in some ways. So, in a way, you have the primary Agada, which is Yecheskel. Then you have the Gemara's five interpretations of who these, let's say, Yecheskel were. And then you have us coming along and interpreting the Gemara. So this, you might say, is a meta-interpretation of Agada. There's the Agada, there's the Gemara interpretation, and then there's our attempt to interpret the interpretation. So it's, to me, interesting. So here's the first one. Amar Rav. Elu b'nei Ephraim shemanu l'keitz v'to. And these are the children of Ephraim who mistakenly counted the time that Geulas Mitzrayim was to have come. And they made a mistake. Shenemru v'nei Ephraim, shuselach u'bara b'no, v'sachas b'no, v'elada b'no, v'sachas b'no, v'zeved b'no, v'shuselach b'no, v'elazar, v'elad, v'harugum anshe gas hanoladim be'eris. These people left Mitzrayim early. They were the descendants of Ephraim, and they were killed by anshe gas and plishtim. So Rashi explains that, if you look at this, it's a kind of a long Rashi. Rashi explains that the question is, when did the Gullus in Mitzrayim, and this is Pesach Dik, when did the Gullus in Mitzrayim start? It says 400 years, Arba Me'oshan in the Bris Ben Absarim. So did it start with Ger Yiyeh Zaracha, which is the birth of Yitzchak, which is the way it's to be counted, or did it start with the time that Avraham got the Nevuah? That Ger Yiyeh Zaracha. So does it begin with Leidas Yitzchak, or does it begin with Bris Ben Absarim? The counting, as it was demonstrated historically, should have been from when Yitzchak was born. But they made a mistake, and they assumed that the counting begins with Avraham's death. So, like, what's so bad about that? I mean, the question to be asked about Rav's shot is, what did they do so wrong? Okay, you know, not so bad. So they miscounted by 30 years and they left. Why was that such a terrible thing?
They left 30 years early?
Yes, they left 30 years early and they were killed in their attempt to leave. They were killed by
Anshe. How did they leave if they were slaves at the time?
It's a good question. Very, very good question.
It just sounds like it wasn't like punishment per se, it was just like this was all within the realm of nature. They left,
but they were killed not in Mitzrayim. They were killed by Anshe Gas.
Yeah, but what we know,
they somehow got out of Mitzrayim.
Somehow they got out of Mitzrayim, which is already a question on its own. But we do know that part of what happened through the whole Yetzias Mitzrayim experience was that the nature of being slaves and being able to be warriors was that's what changed for them. That their nature of being slaves was broken from
right,
them.
Right.
I heard a shot that says when it says that that Hashem is Vayasev, he stopped them from going through the Eretz Plishtim because you know it was close. It says Vayasev is the lashon of Yahaseba. Hashem turned them into stopped them from being slaves. Hashem took them that mentality, told them sit and relax, be like a. You know, and they had to have that slave mentality broken off of them. If they never did, then they're bound to...
Right, so what does that have to do with B'nai Ephraim?
It's because they never had that slave mentality broken off. They weren't warriors. They weren't people. They left and they didn't have anything.
Why weren't they slaves?
Why weren't they? They were
slaves. They were slaves.
No, so. they didn't have the slave mentality broken off of them. So.
He's asking.
Then how did they gain
the wherewithal to pick up and go?
That's a good question. Okay, so here, so this is Rav. Now we're going to look at three interpretations of Rav. Okay, so the first interpretation of Rav is something that appears in the Yaakov Shimonim. I'll give it out to you. Read it. Okay. So, this is in Divrei HaYamim, which is where the pasuk about Bnei Ephraim having left early appears. See Zion, where I've marked off. So Rav says what he says, quoted as saying in our Gemara, that they manu as a case and they made a mistake, they left early. Rabbi Eliezer Omer. Rabbi Eliezer says, and this could be taken at least one way to read Rabbi Eliezer is as an interpretation of Rav. Kol osam shanim shahoyi Yisrael yoshim b'mitzrayim. All those years that Bnei Yisrael were living in Mitzrayim, hayu Bnei Ephraim yoshvin betach sha'anan v'sholei. Bnei Ephraim lived in security and tranquility and comfort. Achaba Gavon or Mibnei Banav Shel Ephraim.
Gon? Nun? Like Yeshua ben Nun? Is it Nun?
Maybe Nun. It's hard to read. Mibnei Banav Shel Ephraim. One of the descendants of Ephraim came, the Amar, and he said, Nigla alaya kadosh baruch hu lahotzi eschem. Maybe it wasn't. HaKadosh Baruch Hu was revealed himself to me to take you out of Mitzrayim. Begavas libo, shehem mizera hamalucha, with the arrogance of their heart that they are descendants of Malucha, namely Yosef, with shehem gibore korach b'molchama, and they were very mighty and powerful in war. Amdu v'lachu b'nehem u'b'noseihem, they got up, took their children and the sons and daughters, the Yatsu Mitzrayim. They managed to leave Mitzrayim. The Amdu HaMitzrayim V'Haragu Kol Giborehem. And now here it's the Mitzrayim gets up, and they killed all of their mighty ones, and so on and so forth. So what you have here is one account of what their chet was. You might say these were failed revolutionaries. They were revolutionary, they rebelled, they were failed, and their failure is related to their aristocracy. Aristocrats as failed revolutionaries. They were privileged, being the descendants of Yosef, who was the viceroy of Mitzrayim. They kind of had a certain arrogance about them, and that arrogance led them to engage in behavior that was ultimately self-destructive. You know, in order to make good decisions, you need to make them in a cool-headed, rational way. And their arrogance, their privilege over generations, clouded their vision and did not enable them to see the truth. And in a way, there's a kind of egoism about this. You know, we're great, we're wonderful, we're okay, we can do this, we're gibore korach. And a true successful revolutionary or leader should be motivated not by a sense of privilege, not by being kind of a waspy aristocrat who went to Princeton and life was great all along and his father was an investment banker for four generations. The leaders of a country should ideally be not privileged, but motivated by a pure desire to do what's good for their people. They regarded themselves as superior to everybody else. We're special. We're aristocrats. We're descendants of Yosef. And ultimately, it's ideals that liberate. If you look at the liberation movements throughout history, it was the ideals. Even take a look at Martin Luther King, who was hardly a flawless leader, but he had a powerful vision of certain ideals of liberty, and they were extremely effective in creating the movement that he created. So you might say their self-inflation resulted in their deflation into bones. Right? It was a kind of mida keneged mida. They were overly inflated with her sense of aristocratic privilege, and so they became deflated into these dry, desiccated bones. But nevertheless, Hashem resurrected them, because ultimately they did want to do something good for the Jews. So their motives were complicated. They were resurrected, but on the other hand, they were punished. So that's one model of understanding what the B'nai Ephraim's failure was. I came across another explanation in the Maral, in his Perish on the Agadotas. And it's quite interesting to my mind. He says that Yaakov Bikesh Lagalos Zakets. Yaakov was focused on the ultimate Geula. And that, who was his favorite grandchild? Favorite son and grandchild, Yosef, and then Ephraim, right? So the Maral conjectures that Ephraim would have gathered for or absorbed from Yaakov's passion, the Galus as a case, this enormous, potent anticipation of the future, of ultimate Geula. And that would have been a part of their bones, you might say, if I can use that expression in this context. I mean, it was deeply embedded in who they were. They heard all these stories from the Zeta sitting at the bed about, you know, the Geula, the Geula, the Geula, the Geula. They were raised on the milk of Geula, and they were impassioned to achieve the Geula. And they were frustrated and frustrated because it wasn't happening. And finally, out of sheer frustration, they said, oh, we're leaving, you know, because they've been raised with this. We're leaving. It's like, you know, Lubavitch, you know, the Mashiach, the Mashiach, the Mashiach, the Mashiach is like a kind of a coiled frustration in there that drives one to take action, which, in fact, Lubavitch did take action, and they haven't brought the Mashiach yet, but they definitely tried in their way to take, you know, to bring the Mashiach. And so there's this frustration. They said, no, we're going to rely on our might, our strength, and we're going to make it happen. And that, too, is a failure. You might call these revolutionaries not aristocrats, but messianic revolutionaries. And their messianism did not come from a rational, careful deliberation of the right and wrong thing to do. It came from pent-up frustration and reliance on strength that was actually not strong enough. And so you find this also in Jewish history. There were messianists, like people who believed they were Mashiach, you know, and they were starting Makarevis Akates, and they wanted to go faster than they should have, more than things were ready, and that resulted in ultimate destruction. I mean, think of, you know, Shabtai Tzvi. Obviously, I want to compare the two, but messianists thought that they were the Mashiach, and so there is this danger of messianism, and that is the way in which Maral more or less reads this Agadot.
What were they in need of redemption for if they were like living the high life?
The Maral is not working with the Yalkut. The Yalkut is one reading. The Maral is just working with our Gemara. He's not working with
the Yalkut. Were they even living the high life? They were Nizara Malucha, but were they still in that state of Malucha?
According to the Yalkut or according to the Maral? Maral doesn't speak about this at all.
They seem to be wholly unaware of the situation that's going on in the Yalkut. They seem to be completely unaware of the situation, and because they were so blinded by the fact that, you know, they're looking for redemption when they aren't really enslaved. And then they get up and they're like, we're going to go, and then it hits them hard what the slavery was when they tried to go and the masters killed them.
Right. Well, what this reminds me of is if you think about the, you know, Martin Luther King and Black Liberation Movement. So there were some very, very wealthy, privileged whites who supported them. I think of Leonard Bernstein and others who became very radicalized. And you know, these men living in privilege, Leonard Bernstein, great conductor.
Lenny.
What?
Sorry,
good Grandpa Lenny. the great composer. So, and he was just one of many of these like really wealthy Upper East Side or Upper West Side people who were very, very successful. And they were like siding with the blacks. And it's like, you know, it's a good thing that they did that. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have done it. But it's a little bit of this like aristocratic privilege. Say, well, these poor blacks are suffering. Let's do something about it. Now, that's helping others, so that's obviously a lot better. But it's the same notion of aristocracy. You know, what are they really, as Mendy's saying, what do they really know about what's going on? Like, you know, they live in Park Avenue in duplex.
The thought did come to my mind, but I wouldn't compare it at all because here it sounds like they victimized themselves even though they weren't to be enslaved, whereas the white privilege that you're talking about is not of people who are victimizing themselves and saying, hey, you know, this is bad, we should fix this because we need to live a better life. No, that's literally selflessness. That's
what I'm picking up and
saying. I don't have to do anything because I could be living the high life, and instead I'm taking away from what could be my cushy lifestyle to help. That doesn't seem like a business. 100%.
I agree. Yes, there's a huge difference between them, and I mentioned it myself, and I agree with you wholeheartedly. But it's there's also sometimes a lack of realism on the part of people who aren't suffering, who try to help those who are suffering, don't really understand.
It sounds more
like
what
you were saying.
It sounds more like a person who makes a lot of a black person who would make a lot of money in America and is very successful and famous, and yet still complains that there's racism around. So that sounds more like
that's
a better muscle.
Okay, I agree. That's true. I don't know if they'd be aristocrats, but yes, I agree with that. All right. I have one final interpretation of Rob, a different way of reading it. It's my own interpretation. You can think about it. Let's focus on Rashi now. Rashi says that the issue was, when did Gullus begin? Did it begin with Avraham or with Ger Yezarecha Yitzchak, the brisbane of Sarah, when Avraham heard about it, or when Yitzchak was born? So Rashi doesn't mention either the Alkut or the Maral. So it seems like he's going in his own direction, and I want to, in effect, try to explain what Rashi might mean. And my suggestion is the following. What was B'nai Ephraim's thesis? The thesis was that as soon as Avram heard about it, he suffered. He was going to suffer. He would have suffered because he's hearing that his children are going to themselves go into Gullus for 400 years. So did the Gullus begin with the Zera Yitzchak, where it would start in some sense, or did it begin with Avram's psychological pain? B'nai Ephraim's Shita is, once Avram heard about it, he was suffering, and that suffering begins Gullus. And that is not, in effect, the way we posken, as it were. It's not, Gullus doesn't begin with Avram's personal psychological suffering. It begins with something more concrete. Yitzchak's having his son Yaakov, who would move to Mitzrayim. So the issue is, psychological suffering count as Gullus? And to assert that it does might be to not take seriously enough the actual physical trauma of Gullus itself. It's to psychologize and to intellectualize what is, you might call, the metaphysics of Gullus, which is the Kur HaBarzel, which is the pain that was designed to, through suffering, enable us to be formed as a people. And the mere suffering and psychologically of a single person may be not to take seriously enough the ultimate significance of Kur HaBarzel. It's a little dilettantish, a little intellectualizing. Gullus is like a really serious business. That psychological suffering isn't meaningful, but it's to reduce, in effect, Gullus to that psychological suffering, and that may have been their error. It was a bit to take Gullus in too lighthearted a way. See what I'm saying? That's one way. It's kind of the intellectual's Gullus. Oh, he's suffering, you know, he feels bad, so Gullus has started. That's maybe a bit too psychological or intellectual and not sufficiently cognizant of the metaphysical significance of Gullus itself. That's a theory I have. Yes.
So not to take away from the fact that it could be that they did start it off from Avram's psychological Gullus, but just maybe, I don't really see how that the problem was that psychological gullus is not as important. I think psychological gullus was a big part of the Gullus in Mitzrayim was psychological, and you see that throughout. You see the fact that Paro says how they have too much time on their hands, they can think about it, and I don't think that focusing on psychological gullus takes away from the physical gods at all. I think that they go in tandem. I think that maybe their error was maybe that Avram wasn't going through psychological gods, because Avram is the person of Emunah. Avram was the person who had faith in God before it was cool. And so when Avram hears that your children are going to be enslaved, Avram says, yes, but I also heard that they're going to be free. So it's kind of like, no, Avram has the full picture. When the Jews are going through the slavery, they are experiencing mm-hmm. slavery. It's not easy for them to say, you know, there are people who...
Cheapening Avram is what you're saying.
Yeah. Saying there are people who went through the slavery, people who were born in Mitzrayim and never experienced Gula. They were in there for 210 years. So there had to be people who were born in slavery and died in slavery. So for Klal Yisrael to have that Emunah, it's not easy. Avram's not experiencing it. All he is told... I'm telling you now that your children will be enslaved, but there will be a great redemption. It'll be the greatest revelation of God in this world. Everything that you
okay,
put
I hear
into
that.
Practice.
That's a good point.
So
that's a good suggestion.
The only thing that they were wrong about was no, Avram is not going suffering. Through that psychological okay. suffering like you think he was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's an interesting point.
Maybe
I hear
they were
that.
Wrong to calculate.
Good suggestion.
It maybe it was just wrong to try to calculate it.
They should have let it happen.
Maybe. When God said, okay, now is time, that's when they ultimately picked up.
You know, by the way, this whole issue comes up with Zionism and founding the State of Israel, where they, you know, was those who criticize, Yom HaZvot is coming up, those who criticize the Zionists believed that they were Mechashvei Esakets. This is the phrase that they use, that they were like trying to move things along too quickly and let's let the Gula happen when it does. And they were like a fry and they anticipated they
would. Happened to the eagle also, when miscalculations also. It's like just let it happen. Moshe's going to come back when it's going to come back. They try to calculate it one way, Moshe meant it in a different way, and we see what happens.
Right.
So
right.
being Mechashvei Esakets is never a good
thing. In Israel, that did leave Mitzrayim, it wasn't. It wasn't a question of, oh, well, yeah, we calculated from a different time than they did. It was more like Hashem said this is the time.
Right.
And
right,
then they
right.
picked up and left.
It's similar to after the Chet Egel, so B'nai Yisrael were punished. They can't go to Eretz Yisrael, but there were still people who left. Anyway, they said, no, we're going to go to Eretz Yisrael. And they weren't the... Etzim Ragam. Right. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we're not going to, you know... Hashem says, no, you can't go to Eretz Yisrael. And then... they go anyway, and they all get killed. It's the same kind of drive to go beyond what the framework requires. This Gemara, that issue with the Pasuk there, all come up in the discussion with Zionism. So, all right. Anyway, let's continue. So that's Rav. Shmuel Amar, Elu b'nei Adam shekafru b'tchias ha-mesem. These are people who deny the possibility of Tchias HaMesim. Shenemar Vayomer Eli Ben Adam HaAtzamos Ela Kol Beis Yisrael. These bones, Hashem tells Yecheskel, are Beis Yisrael. Hine Omrim Yofshu Asmosenu V'Avda Sikvasenu. They're saying our bones are dried, our hope is lost. And... in effect, these are people who were kofar and tchias ha-mesim. So Shmuel situates these people in the debate between the Perushim and the Tzedukim. The Perushim believed in tchias ha-mesim. Tzedukim denied tchias ha-mesim because it's not explicitly mentioned in the Torah. This whole long sugya in Perek HaChelek says, Elu she'en lahem chelek l'olam haba. One of them is the class of people who deny tchias ha-mesim. Whole long sugya proved Tchias HaMesim from various psukim, attempt to do so. And these are folks who did not buy into that. They were, in effect, the proto-Tzedukim. You know, they didn't believe in Tchias HaMesim. Obviously, historically, the Tzedukim didn't exist at that time, but it's a sensibility the Gemara is drawing analogies to. And what they're saying, to deny Tchias HaMesim is to say, of the Tikvaseinu. To say that there is no hope once a person dies, there is no future, and that lack, that hopelessness was true of those Jews who were living at that time, that they believed in Gullus, Jews were being attacked, and in Gullus there was no future. Nei Yisrael, Avda Sikvaseinu. So that is the national analog to an individual person's feeling with death, Avda Sikvaseinu. There is the individual. Avda Sikvaseinu, after death, there is no future. There's the national Avda Sikvaseinu, which Yecheskel is addressing, and Shmuel's drawing a strict analogy between the two. If you are a personal avda dikvaseinu, you will be a national avda sikvaseinu, and vice versa. If you believe that there can be a future for Klal Yisrael, you can believe in the future for Tchias HaMesim. These were people who were hopeless, personally, nationally, and they became, so they had, to be full of hope is to be full of a future. And to be dry bones is to be desiccated, dry, empty, nothing can happen. And so the consequence of their denial of Tchias HaMesim was to become what they believed. Was they physically embodied what it means not to have Tchias HaMesim or hope for the future of the Jewish people. They became that. So they, in effect, became what they were. And nevertheless, they were resurrected. And that's how Kadosh Baruch Hu's promise that people and the Klal Yisrael will be resurrected. So that's Shmuel's approach. Okay, the next one is Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba Amar Elu b'nei Adam she'ein bohem lachluchis shal mitzvah. These are people who don't have the moisture of mitzvahs, shenemer ha'atzamos ha'aveshos, these dried bones. So this is a very interesting interpretation. It's called, the Gemara calls mitzvos lachluchis shal mitzvah. And I find this very, I find that to be a very striking metaphor. And we think about Pesach, we just, you know, finished Pesach. I mean, just think of how rich and beautiful and succulent our lives are as a result of the Maisa mitzvahs of Pesach, eating matzah and marar and the seder and egadah talabinacha and the whole, it's just such a, look how blessed we are to have such a rich life full of Maisa mitzvahs. So all the mitzvahs that we do, Shabbos, Lulav and Esrog, they add such vibrancy and life to our lives that if you don't keep mitzvahs, you are dry. You know, if you think about it in your own life, just think about how much mitzvahs enrich your life. They just add so much power and beauty and consciousness of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They had no lachluchis of mitzvah. There was an absence, I would put it also in these terms, mitzvahs give our life meaning. You do a mitzvah and you feel like you're connecting to Hashem. They create a framework for us to have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you don't have mitzvahs, then you don't have that context to have an ongoing relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Mitzvahs promote that. And so if you don't have that, and life sometimes has no meaning. Like, what's the point? And by the way, you see this amongst many people who don't keep mitzvahs. Their lives are often, you know, they float. They don't have any significance. They're busy with their Facebook, amongst many, many other social media things. You know, there's nothing there. There's not enough there. Mitzvahs give our life meaning. And the absence of mitzvahs is the lachluchis of mitzvahs. Connection to Hashem, meaning in life. Those are the 2 points I'm making. And they also, in a sense, became what they were. They didn't have that, so they were dry bones. And that's what you are if you don't have a life of Torah mitzvahs. Yes, Bendy?
I guess I don't really know the story not well enough. Do we know that these people were Rishon? Because each one we're giving examples of wicked people or people who did something wrong. Is it possible that they're just people who die? Because everyone dies. So what was striking
about this is you had a conglomeration of skeletons inside of one valley. What are they all doing there inside the valley? They weren't just like people scattered around their homes, became skeletons, nor were they buried, which is also another thing. So the fact that they were all together in one place and they weren't buried is highly unusual, which suggests that they had some story.
I guess the Nimshal also speaks a lot stronger if there were people who you would think could never come back to having life, people who were sinners, people who had no lachlukas of mitzvahs, any of these people who went against what God wanted. So I guess even those people can come back.
Exactly. There's no avda sikvaseinu. That's a very positive message that we're getting from all these interpretations of the Gemara, even these people resurrected. Okay, next, Pshat. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha Amar Elu B'day Adam Shechifu Chifu Es Hahechal Kulo Shkatsim Urmasim. These are people who covered the entire walls of the Beis Hamikdash with Shkatsim Urmasim, idols, pictures of idols. They brought idolatry, pagan worship into the Beis Hamikdash. So this is just, in some ways, it's similar to people of no mitzvahs, but this in some ways is even worse, because not only that, not are they not being Mekayim mitzvahs necessarily, maybe they are, I don't know, but they also believe in Avodah Zarah. One way to think about it is that they believed in lots of gods. So there was too much going on in their life. You're supposed to believe in only one. And they didn't believe in only one, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they believed in many, many different gods. In effect, they became what they weren't. They became bones when they were full of too many things. So this was like also a kind of mida keneged mida result. So that's his interpretation. And then we come to the last, and in some ways, one of the most interesting, I think, is Rabbi Yochanan Amar. Rabbi Yochanan said, Elu meisim shel bikas dura. These are the dead people in Bikas Dura, and here's the story. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Minar Oshel Eshel Ad Rabbas Bika Dura, Shebishah Shehigla Nebuchadnezzar Harasha Es Yisrael. When Nebuchadnezzar drove Harasha, drove the Jews into exile, Hayu Bahen Bachurim Shahayu Meganen Es Hachama Biyofion. They were young men who were so handsome that they shamed the sun with their beauty. They glowed with this incredible beauty, and their glow of their beauty put the very sun to shame. So they were like remarkably handsome young guys. Vayu Castillos Roos O Sun, and Castillos, females from Kastiv, saw them, Vishofos Zavos, and they became Zavos as a result of their passion for these extraordinarily handsome young men. Amru Labal, I don't know what the biology there is, but anyway, Amru Labalehem, they said to their, this was told to their husbands, Ubalehem Lamelech, and their king, the husbands reported this to the king, that these married women were now all falling in love with these really handsome Jewish exiles, and the husbands didn't like this, so they reported it to the king. Tziva hamelach v'haragum, and the king commanded them and killed them. Vadayin hayu shofos zavos, and they were still so handsome even in their death that the women were still impassioned and in love with or desirous of these now corpses. Tziva hamelach urumasu. The king commanded they have them crushed so that they would be utterly unattractive to... So that's like pretty interesting. Now what's interesting to my mind in part is, what do we know about Rabbi Yochanan?
He was very attractive.
He was very handsome. Rabbi Yochanan was so handsome that he used to stand as women were leaving the mikvah, and his goal was that they would see him as they left the mikvah, and they would be so inspired by his beauty that they would turn after they went back to their husbands to have children who were as handsome and as knowledgeable in Torah as Rabbi Yochanan.
Sounds so convoluted, but yeah.
I only report to you what the Gemara says. The Gemara also says that he was so beautiful. The Gemara says he put a rose next to a silver cup, and the sun shines, and he had the glow of this rose shining against the silver of a bright sun. He was obviously exceptionally handsome. And here Rabbi Yochanan sees that. Now, what's the difference between Rabbi Yochanan and these Bachurim? These Bachurim, you know, they were not trying to hide from these Castillos, right?
Do we know that?
We have no evidence that they were. Rabbi Yochanan used...
They were
killed. Rabbi Yochanan... Now, they probably, I would suggest, were not... You know, they took pride in their beauty. Rabbi Yochanan was very conscious of his beauty, how handsome he was. Very conscious of it. But what did Rabbi Yochanan do with his handsomeness?
Didn't hide from the girls from the mikvah.
He used it for, Mendy, please calm down. He used it for elevated purposes. He took his beauty. What Rabbi Yochanan also, we know, had a tragic life. And he carried the bone of his 10th son, who was killed a horrific death, with him in his pocket to empathize with others who were suffering, who had lost children. So Rabbi Yochanan was obviously quite an extraordinary man, and he was very self-conscious or aware of his beauty, but he exploited it for elevated purposes so that women could have children who were as handsome and as Talmidei Chachamim like he was. These Bachrim, who are the subject of Yochanan's Agaduta, are the absolute, I would suggest, opposite to Rabbi Yochanan. They didn't do anything to hide from this Castillos. The Castillos were lusting after them. They didn't say, okay, let's, cover ourselves with robes, let's go hide in a cave, let's not get into this. They, in effect, did the opposite of what Rabbi Yochanan did with their beauty. And I would say that they didn't suffer from an absence of values, but you might say they suffer from misplaced values. It was they valued their handsomeness. They valued their sensuality. And they didn't hide it, like Rabbi Yochanan, who used it for higher purposes, for elevated purposes. Was it aesthetic on their part? Was it sensual? I don't really know, but what they're doing is they're kind of misplacing their values. So unlike the absence of values in the case of Ein Bahem Lachluchus Shel Mitzvah, unlike an overabundance of values in the case of Ovdei Avodah Zarah, where there are too many gods, here they had a misplaced value in that they valued their beauty or their sensuality, and that was to put an emphasis on what shouldn't be emphasized. And they too were killed, but they were also resurrected. Yes?
I point from before, do we know that for certain, that they did something wrong?
We don't know for certain, but I think that's the likelihood because A, they were punished, and B, the story could have been that they figured out how to avoid this problem with the women. They weren't interested. Apparently, they weren't interested in avoiding it because otherwise they could have. As they reveled, they were young guys. They were Bachram, a 17-year-old handsome guy with all these beautiful wives, women, lusting after them. Who can blame them, really, for their attitude? They were young. They were Bachram. They weren't themselves married. And they failed. Nobody's saying that they were the world's worst people, but there's no evidence that they try to avoid it. And Bachram, they're young.
It's not surprising. It's reminiscent of what happens in America, like Mohammed, but
yes.
With Jews taking the forefront, people liking things from Jews, and then anti-Semitism rises from that.
Interesting. I was actually thinking about these young movie stars.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Dead Jewish.
There's... Hollywood is built for...
Exactly. Jews. So these young movie stars, they very, very beautiful or handsome, and they revel in it. They build a life on it, and that life collapses because Britney Spears... No, what's the name of this woman who keeps on getting arrested? Britney Spears?
I don't know. There's a lot of them.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who's
Britney Spears? I can't remember who it is, but somebody who's very beautiful, like woman, Hollywood star, whatever, keeps on getting arrested. That kind of a life where you focus exclusively on how attractive you are is an empty life. And that is to be a bone, to be a dry bone, not to have any meaning in your life. And I think those Bachrim were kind of like that in that sense. So that is another reading of it. So just to, we have to, just to step back from here, we have five different interpretations. And what we have is an Agadata, in effect, the story in Yechezkel. We have the Gemara's trying to figure out what this Agadata means. And then those of us sitting around this table trying to figure out what the Gemara is figuring out of these Agadotas mean, it's a multi-step process. And that's what makes learning so interesting and wonderful. Okay, everybody.
I wasn't trying to be
raunchy
before. I was actually saying I don't see why we say that.